Blog Talk Radio.
Did you miss us? Welcome to the big show, Movie Geeks United. Welcome.
Welcome. I'm Jerry, and I want to answer your question before the music. Yeah, I missed us.
Yes.
How's that? I miss us.
I miss us every day. Chris, I miss you too, my friend.
Oh, I'm always missing you. I wake up, first thing I think of when I wake up is, where's Jamie? And then I look to my left, and I see you on the other side of the bed.
So. There you go, folks. Yeah. That's what makes our show better than everyone else's. We're that upfront and honest with each other.
That's right.
We really go the distance.
Yeah. We don't have a don't ask, don't tell policy on this show.
No, not at all.
No.
So what's up, guys? Chris, since you got out of your schooling, since you graduated,
mm-hmm.
have you been to the theater at all?
I did last week go see Star Trek.
Very good.
The only movie that I've gone to see in the show. Not true, actually. I saw State of Play also. Star Trek, I thought, was pretty amazing. I don't know if you guys spoken about it yet.
We haven't talked about it at all, but I agree with everything that you said there, Chris.
It's pretty incredible. I was never a Star Trek fan. It doesn't, like, the show or Next Generation or Enterprise or Deep Space Nine or Babylon 5 or all the movies, like, I never got it, like, with all that. But one two-hour movie made me understand all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
One movie made me understand how people call themselves Trekkies and go to conventions. And, I mean, it was incredibly exciting. Not much of a story, but the story is kind of the characters. And the two main characters, Kirk and Spock, are so well created,
mm-hmm.
so well played by those two actors that you don't need any more story. That's the story, those two guys and their relationship. And it's
true.
I had a pretty awesome time watching it, actually.
That's great.
The happiest theater-going experience I've had in a long time. And Chris, there's really, after like the original series, I'm not a big fan. I mean, I never got into anything after the original series, to be very honest with you.
Except Star Trek 2.
The Next Generation movies I thought were pathetic at best.
There was a couple of them I could watch, and I didn't hate them, but I didn't ever really get it. I will say also that I saw a digital print of Star Trek, and that, of course, can make a big difference. So I would definitely suggest anyone go see the digital print.
Where did you go to see that?
At the Cobb Theater here in town.
Oh, they had it there.
Yeah, they got the digital. Yeah, and it looks and sounds incredible.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, absolutely incredible. And it's funny, too, because I think that movie cost less than Wolverine, and I hate to get into Wolverine again. And I won't,
yeah, really?
But,
why are you doing that, man?
Well, it's just, I'm pointing out that, you know, one guy can take $150 million and another guy can take it. You get two completely different products. Wolverine looks like it was made for $50 million, and it actually costs three times that. Whereas I would believe if I didn't know and you told me that Star Trek was the most expensive film ever made, it seems like it because it's on screen, you know. It's incredible.
It's one of those films I can't think of anything wrong with it. I just really I haven't been to a movie like the people coming out of the previous screening, everyone had a smile on their face, and I can't think of really the last time I've seen that.
No.
I mean, everyone was just happy. The movie just did some sort of euphoria that is just created throughout the movie. I never thought I'd say that about a Star Trek film.
I know. I feel the same way. And actually, I was near tears at the beginning of the movie. And the opening scene of the movie, it really grabs you right away with some serious emotion.
Yeah, I've been hearing that a lot about that opening scene. and Jerry, you actually saw something this weekend.
You make it sound like I got witness. No, Angels and Demons, which if we can just is the exact opposite feeling of Star Trek. More like lethargic as opposed to euphoric. It suffers, Chris, actually from the same problem I think that all three of us had with the last Indiana Jones movie, and that's too much exposition. Just too much explaining of things going on, you know, instead of there's a lot of telling but not a lot of showing.
Yeah, that's kind of to be expected out of one of those books, I think.
But that works fine in a thriller of that caliber. You know, having I read The Da Vinci Code, I never read Angels and Demons, but I had the same problem with Da Vinci Code. There's just so much explanation. You want acting. You don't want you want storytelling from these things. You don't want this is what happened here. This is and that's not movie making.
Yeah, that's fine on the page because it makes for an interesting read, and you can put it down. You can take all that information in and say, okay, I need to put this down for a couple minutes. Well, on the screen, they got to jam-pack that all in, and yeah, that's the problem Da Vinci Code had, although I will say it certainly wasn't sluggish at the box office.
No. Like Da Vinci Code or Angels and Demons?
Yeah, I mean, Angels and Demons underperformed Da Vinci.
Yeah, but it's still pretty incredible. Like, I mean, it overperformed Star Trek. Like, it blew that out of the water.
But this is what we were saying last week, and this is the funny thing about it. Da Vinci Code, and I knew this wouldn't perform as well, because Da Vinci Code is a $750 million worldwide hit, and you can't find anybody that likes it. Nobody talks about liking Da Vinci Code.
Yeah,
the movie.
That said, this thing has already made $152 million worldwide. Like, it's already... I mean, yeah, like, you're right. I agree with you. And I don't know anyone that likes Da Vinci Code, myself included.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's number one at the box office. A lot of people went and saw it. Yeah, it didn't do as well as Da Vinci Code, but if you talk to 10 people you know, a couple of them went and saw it this weekend.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, though. Like, there was another time... Like, this Dan Brown's third book, I don't know the exact title, but his books do really well. The Da Vinci Code came out at the right time, and I remember we were given advanced copies when I worked at Borders, and they said, we're expecting this book to do really well. And I gave it to my mom to read, and she said it was The Name of the Rose for Dummies, essentially, was her summary of the book. But
basically what... Stellan Skarsgård said about it.
Yeah,
too,
I saw that. I got a good chuckle out of that. But it was another time these books, these bestsellers, like remember Robert Ludlum too, these were reserved for miniseries where you could like spend three or four nights you know, with these books where you could have the exposition where that made sense, you know, hey, well, we've got like 8 hours to work with here. You know,
you're absolutely right.
But
I hadn't thought about it, but you're right.
There is something else, though. There is something with... the skill of the director involved, too, in handling exposition.
Mm-hmm.
And we all like Ron Howard. We like him.
I
think he's a competent director, and he's often very good. But all of his stuff is performance-centered. You don't hear many people talking about the performances in these two films, necessarily. But if you look at something like JFK, which is 3 hours of exposition...
Mm-hmm.
Oliver, it doesn't feel like it because
of the
kinetic, you know, energy of Oliver Stone. I don't see Ron Howard as an energetic director.
No, it doesn't seem like it. You're right, and actually, the JFK parallel is an interesting one to make because I was going to say, you know, I mean, and it is true. There's so much exposition in these two books. Like you read Da Vinci Code, right, Jamie?
Yeah.
I didn't read Angels and Demons either, but I have heard that it's essentially the same. It's written the same sort of way. It's just packed with exposition.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a ton. I mean, I don't know that there is a way to make it seamless the way that Stone did with JFK with these movies. I don't know if that's possible. But I do know that I'm not interested in going to see it because I didn't. I'm one of those people that you said, you know, I saw The Da Vinci Code opening weekend, and I didn't like it.
Right.
And I did like the book, but I just don't know that these work well on screen. I think Jerry's absolutely right. This miniseries is where these should have been made.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that was
I liked the
director.
Book, too. I thought the book just went by in a flash. You know, I read it in a couple hours. It was perfect kind of, you know, beach book kind of thing.
Yeah, it was a fun book to read, and you do learn a couple things. I learned. I mean, I won't deny it. There was things I didn't know in there. You know, I mean, it was interesting.
Yeah, you learned interesting tidbits. There's no doubt about this. And you know, they're heralding this guy's third book as the book that will save Doubleday because the publishing industry is in trouble. And they said that his book that I think comes out September or October, they said this book will essentially save the publishing industry. They're that confident that everyone will rush out and buy it in hardback.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we can expect another film in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that the backlash about these books, you know, people calling them this or that for dummies, it's literary snobbism or whatever you want to call it, you know, just because people aren't reading Dostoevsky or whatever.
No, I mean, it's just, what amazed me about these, there's a lot of books like the Da Vinci Code, and I was really, because people would always write, well, whether you like other books like this, and there are a lot of other books like this. Wilbur Smith's The Seventh Scroll, Alan Folsom's The Day After Tomorrow and Day of Judgment, any Robert Ludlum book for that matter.
Right, exactly.
It's just that this guy took a subject matter, took something very controversial at the time, or any time, really, I mean, the origins of Christianity, and was able to, you know, work magic with it.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Cannes Film Festival. There are some reports of movies coming out of there that we're very interested in. Of course, the big one, Inglourious Basterds, I think that doesn't premiere until Wednesday.
Mm-hmm,
so
yeah.
First thing Thursday morning, we'll be hearing reviews from Variety and other periodicals about that film. But there's some interesting news there. Tetro, the new Coppola film, is getting lukewarm reviews. They say it's not the disaster Youth Without Youth was.
Mm-hmm.
But it has some very competent, heartfelt moments. But on the whole, it's still the auteur playing amateur with Coppola and his new directorial trajectory that he's taking. Some of the other films, Up, of course, was their opening night film, and 3D Up, and that's universally praised. I haven't read a single negative about that film.
Yeah, I was about to say quietly, but it's not very quiet at all. Pixar is on hell of a run. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I know that's not news. I know that you don't need to listen to a show to hear that, but it is
right.
Pretty incredible, the run that they're on, you know.
Yeah.
And I want to see it, too. Like, it's
yeah.
a testament. I don't like to see children's movies, as a rule, but anytime something says Pixar, I will see it. So I
yeah,
don't
you go out of your way for that.
Yeah.
They say it's, like, very, it's their most adult film yet. It's kind of pushing those boundaries. I mean, there's a miscarriage in the first 10 minutes of the movie. It deals with kind of adult themes, and some of their best stuff is in that opening 10 minutes. It's like a 4-minute musical interlude that they say is some of the best stuff they've ever done. The other movie that's universally praised out of the festival is a surprising one, and it's called Precious. It's the new Lee Daniels film, they say that there are award-worthy turns in this movie from Monique and Mariah Carey.
I believe it.
Well, now, this isn't a surprise, though, is it? Because this is the movie
Sundance.
This was the movie that was renamed. This was called Push originally, and it came out at Sundance
mm-hmm.
right around the same time as that god-awful X-Men ripoff Push movie with Chris. I mean, come on, that's what it was. But
but this shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. This book is a constant seller by Sapphire,
mm-hmm.
and at Sundance they couldn't. This was the big hit of Sundance, if I'm not mistaken.
So you're not saying you're not saying that it's a surprise that Mariah Carey gives an award-worthy performance.
No, that's not what I'm saying at all.
Well, that's the point I was making.
I know that's the point you're making. But if you remember, she made a movie with Mira Sorvino after Glitter,
yeah.
which was the safest place to be after 9/11. Wise
yeah.
Girls, that she got a lot of good notices for, so it doesn't surprise me.
I think it should, but Monique, they say if they're brave enough to nominate her, they should. And I just saw the trailer to this, and it looks absolutely heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be hearing a lot more about that movie mm-hmm. as it comes around, I'm sure. Another movie, the reviews just came out for it. It just screened. This is the new Lars von Trier's movie, Antichrist.
Yeah, this looks so interesting.
Yeah, it does.
And the Austin critic said it's not often that you leave a movie and feel like you've just experienced a moment in cinematic history.
Yeah.
He says, Antichrist made me feel that way. It's the most controversial film he's ever done.
That's saying something right there.
Half the room was applauding and the other half was booing. They say the movie's violence had an emotional impact that I haven't seen since Irreversible.
Mm.
Because you care about the characters long before the violence comes.
Right, okay. Hmm. That he's most controversial, though. That's the thing that gets me, because this is a guy who just thrives on it. And his other, the other controversial guy, has Michael Haneke's film, The White Ribbon, I think it's called, has that premiered yet?
I haven't heard anything about it yet.
Yeah, okay.
But in terms of Antichrist, they say this movie is probably going to be one of the hardest NC-17 ratings ever.
Yeah, well, you can tell that by the poster. I think
yeah.
they have Willem Dafoe banging some chick on, like, a tree full of souls or something like that. Like,
good for him, man. I'm glad to see he has not mellowed at all with age. Good for Willem Dafoe.
Well, that's a Friday night for Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, dude, that's a Thursday morning for him.
That's a Tuesday, yeah. the big news will be Inglourious Basterds, the big question mark. And Tarantino said that if this movie's a big hit, he's already got a prequel written for it.
Oh, God, there he goes again.
I don't make it a habit of reading scripts. I only read a script one time before it came out. I'll sometimes go back and read a script for a movie that I love.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't make it a habit of reading scripts beforehand. I did it once with Dogma, and it kind of ruined the movie for me. I love Dogma, but as I was watching it,
mm-hmm.
you know, I wasn't able to be surprised, and I wasn't able to enjoy it. You know, it's just like reading a book.
Right.
But so I avoided the Inglourious Basterds script, although it's, you know, it's, you can get it. Like, it's perfectly available online. But Vanity Fair printed the opening scene,
mm-hmm.
and I read it because I was just, you know, sitting on the can and reading, and, well, you know, why the hell not?
That's right.
And I got to tell you, I was pretty engrossed by it, and
mm-hmm.
I really wanted to know what was going to happen next. I was left, you know, literally holding my Johnson. it's a pretty striking opening scene, and the dialogue is very intriguing. He's doing something a little different with dialogue here. Obviously, he has to. You know, it's a World War II movie.
Yeah.
But it's very, very, very interesting sounding. I'm really looking forward to it now. After having read that, my hopes have shot through the roof.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just curious. So we got still 2 months. What is it? 2 or 3 months till this comes out.
Yeah, till we'll see it.
Yeah, I mean, are they gonna if the word of mouth is incredibly good? Do you think they'll push it up?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't.
I didn't think so, but I would love it if they would.
Well, I think it's in a perfect spot if the word of mouth is good, and I think the timing is good, too, because, you know, August is when it's dying down, the summer season is dying down.
You don't think G.I. Joe will have an incredible second weekend?
No, I don't. I mean, it could. I don't want to go on record and make a prediction like that, because I don't know. You know, I have no idea. Maybe that movie could be good, you know?
You never know, dude. You never know with those kind of things. The nostalgia
factor.
He made
the Mummy. He made The Mummy, and that movie was huge, you know. And
it definitely looks like a Stephen Sommers movie, that's for sure.
Well, there's no doubt about that.
It really does.
Yeah, which isn't a compliment to
my
book.
I don't think anyone who listens to this show took that as a compliment.
Good, good. Speaking of when we're talking about Antichrist and controversial, Entertainment Weekly came out with a list of the 25 most controversial movies ever. And maybe I'm out of the loop. I don't sense controversy in some of these.
Read them off. Let's hear these.
Number 25 is Aladdin.
Aladdin.
You've got to be kidding me, right? I mean, this is like, what did was this bring? Let the kids come to work and do their work for them day that they did this? I mean, what?
I have no idea. I guess it's a racial stereotypes typing or something. I'm not sure.
Oh, God. Okay.
That's just being a little too sensitive.
Yeah, that is.
24, I'm sure it belongs here, is Caligula. I'll go with that.
I would go with that. It looked like everyone's having a good time on the set, though. But, yeah, sure, we'll go with that.
Number 23 is Kids. Yes, that belongs there.
Yeah, I'm surprised Kids is quite so in the 20s. Like, that's pretty shocking. That movie is still pretty shocking to watch, actually.
Yeah. Do the Right Thing, number 22.
Yes, definitely. I can see that being on that list. Belongs there.
21, Bonnie and Clyde. Yeah, because it was the first, and
I could see at the time, but I could see at the time, yeah, at the time it came out, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number 20, I haven't seen this, Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah, that's always going to be there, dude. It's a good movie. It is what it is. It's like what Cloverfield and Diary of the Dead and all these movies owe their livelihood, and Blair Witch Project owe their livelihoods to, but... yeah, I guess it's going to be that. I'm still kind of shocked Kids is on there, because Kids, I think, is mild, personally, by today. Just as there's been
well, we're not talking about by today's standards. We're talking about at the time they're released.
Oh, God.
I mean,
okay.
By today's standards, nothing is controversial.
Yeah, that's true.
But Cannibal Holocaust, the controversy, after its 1980 Milan premiere, the film's print was confiscated by the city's magistrate. Later, the director faced life in prison when Italian authorities believed the stars of his film were actually killed.
Wow.
Right, that's the rumor that still floats around with that movie. You
mm-hmm.
still hear people
yeah.
saying, you know, that movie has actual death in it.
Yeah,
I've never seen it either, but I think Jerry's right. I think that's one of those ones that I've always heard of.
Mm-hmm.
I know somebody who likes it. You know, it just didn't really ever strike me as something I would want to watch, though.
Yeah, let's go out and rent Cannibal Holocaust. That sounds like
a
great time.
Yeah, that Passion of the Christ double feature, an irreversible triple feature. There you go.
Well, we're getting to those.
Mm-hmm.
Number 19 is Basic Instinct.
Not even at the time it's released do I consider it shocking.
But it's not shocking.
That's insulting. That's insulting to anyone who makes shocking movies.
There was controversy about that.
I know
that,
there's controversy. Well, I know there's controversy because of the one scene, but please, for this, there's nothing controversial about that movie.
Well,
time.
It's just an awful movie, but there were protests and things around it. So, yeah, all right.
Yeah.
I Am Curious, number 18.
Which, I Am Curious Yellow, I Am Curious Pink, which one?
Yellow.
Yellow, okay.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, if you want to go there.
I would be curious about Pink, but it's yellow. Freaks is number 17.
It will always be on that list. Always.
Yeah. Yeah. You've seen Freaks, Chris, have you?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, dude, it's always going to be on there.
Wow,
I think that movie's actually kind of special for the time it came from
mm-hmm.
to watch
yeah.
it. Even today, it's pretty amazing to think
it's
of when that movie came out.
It's still a freaky film.
Yeah, it actually is, yeah.
And there's a great biography that came out in the 90s about the man who made it, Todd Browning, called Dark Carnival, that I would really recommend everyone read. It's just a superb book about the making of that movie and that man's life. So
I actually would not be surprised if we saw an unfortunate remake of that movie very soon. Because it's
I'm afraid
movies.
You're right. I'm sure there are plans to remake it.
And they'll do all the CGI, remove all legs, and they'll be like Lieutenant Dan's all over the movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Number 16 is United 93.
Mm.
Was there controversy surrounding that movie?
I think only the too soon question that would plague any movie that came out first, you know.
Right, right.
But strangely, that question was snuffed out immediately when that
by
movie
the quality
was
of the film,
quality
yeah.
of
good.
By how sensitive the subject and how tastefully the subject was handled.
Yeah, I mean Chris is absolutely right.
Yeah. Number 15 belongs here. Triumph of the Will.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's. Let me ask you this, though. Obviously, it's controversial because of the director, and, you know, she never really owned up to the fact that she was, you know, she knew, but that's not the thing. It's the influence of the film on modern cinema, though, is what I find astounding.
Well, it's the opposing nature of the project.
Yeah.
On one hand, you admire the heck out of it because of the grandeur of its filmmaking.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And yet, it's propaganda for the Nazi Party.
Oh yeah. Oh dude. The paradox is there. Don't get me wrong. It's just I'm always amazed that when you're watching films, even movies today, you can see the influence of that film in so many films. It's mind blowing.
Yeah, like Schindler's List. Amazing. commonality there. The Warriors, number 14, Walter Hill.
Was that controversial?
What was the controversy at the time that was released?
Hill's lurid nightmare of urban warfare was widely condemned for glorifying violence. Reports of criminal incidents where the film was shown, including the stabbing of a teenager in Massachusetts, fueled this outrage, forcing Paramount to temporarily pull all advertising for the film.
He's actually, you're not so far from the truth there, because that film, like, when I was growing up, that was people, a lot of kids I went to high school, including myself, like elementary school, junior high, kids loved that film. We grew up on that. A lot of people thought that was, like, that was the thing, that movie was like the be-all, end-all of gangs.
Well, there was just a movie that came out that inspired violence outside of theaters a few weeks ago. What was that? I remember reading reports. Somebody was shot in the theater or something. And I remember when I, in theater exhibition, when we played Boys in the Hood, which otherwise, I mean, it's an excellent, sensitive, compassionate movie. But it still, we had shootings all over some theaters here locally.
That happened with Higher Learning, too. There were a couple shootings there.
That happened with Poetic Justice, was the worst for us for some darn reason. It's a love story with Janet Jackson, and we had a riot in our theater when we played it.
But, yeah, that happened during the 90s because that happened with Menace to Society, too.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate. Great movies, but marred by violence.
Number 13, it's familiar, The Da Vinci Code. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there was worldwide protest about the movie. But
it helped the movie and the book.
It just seems to me that the real beef was with the book, and the movie just let that protest gain more publicity.
Uh-huh. But this is where this is where I have a problem with these lists. Sometimes, because you step back from it and take a look at it, and you say, okay, yes, that was controversial, but more controversial than Triumph of the Will.
Right.
It doesn't certainly doesn't seem more controversial than that movie.
Mm. Right.
Maybe this belongs at number 25 or something like that, you know?
Yeah, once again, I think Chris has a good point, because Da Vinci Code's the controversy about, I mean, the book it was there for many years, and then the movie came out. I actually think the movie, because of the quality of the movie or whatever, just sort of nullified the controversy almost, numbed it.
Yeah.
Right.
And the fact
right.
that it was Tom Hanks and Ron Howard, and it was a major studio release, it sort of, watered it down, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We do have parallel chat rooms going on.
Okay, yeah, I was afraid of that. I see Jason on the thing, and Jason and Tim Price, but they're not in the main chat room, so...
Yeah, I did that intentionally. Okay, our next controversial film, number 12, is The Deer Hunter.
Okay, that's because of the... He got controversy both times, Cimino, for this in Year of the Dragon, for like his portrayal of Asians, and eventually
right.
the Vietnamese in this.
Yeah, and also the timing was probably controversial with Deer Hunter. It was one of the early, Vietnam movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it really focused on that Russian roulette scene, which is the centerpiece, the most powerful moment of the film.
Right.
It was that big back and forth struggle between the Deer Hunter and coming home.
Right.
So it had that timing issue. Number 11, waiting for my computer to upload.
Okay.
Give me a moment. The Message, 1977, directed by Mustafa Akkad, the producer of the Halloween films.
Right.
Anthony Quinn plays Muhammad's uncle in an epic telling of Islam's origins. The movie upset Muslims and sparked riots, and that was just during production. Post-release... terrorists took more than 100 people hostage in Washington, D.C., killing a reporter and shooting the city's future mayor, Marion Barry, in a two-day siege, demanding in part that film be banned. So that would qualify as controversial.
That would but Marion Barry, wow, he's just all over the place. He's my mayor, don't forget that. He's our mayor here for Mayor for Life. He was shot? Really? Wow, okay.
Yeah. And, you know, ironically, that director was killed in a terrorist bombing in 2005. Akkad. Yeah, we spoke to his son, remember?
Yes, yes, I know.
Yes.
This is, you know, I mean, it's just, Marion, you got to forgive me, you bring Marion Barry's, like, name, like, just sucks the oxygen out of the room. I was at a premiere of Miller's Crossing, and he's sat in front of us, and he has the biggest hands in the world. I mean, just enormous hands.
Yeah, but better to hold a crack pipe with, right?
Yeah, I was just about to say that.
I mean, talk about bitch setting you up. I mean,
number 10 is Elia Kazan's baby doll. A Mississippi cotton gin owner humiliates a competitor by attempting to seduce the man's still virgin wife. It's a Tennessee Williams script. Catholic leaders found it crude.
Mm-hmm. What's cool about this list, though, is if you could get like younger viewers to like rent some of these films, like Baby Doll, that's awesome.
This isn't like that other list that we read of, I can't remember, it was similar in tone to this, and everything was post-1980.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I think it was
yeah,
a
I,
cult.
Remember, I do remember doing that, yes.
Yeah, was that cult films?
Yes, or underappreciated films.
Underappreciated films. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. We're just like, what?
Yeah. Okay, number 9 belongs here, probably higher. One of my all-time favorites, Last Tango in Paris.
Mm. Never look at stick of butter the same way ever again.
Yes. And this I've always said, this runs completely counterpoint to a movie like Basic Instinct. In its portrayal of sexuality and its honest, non-titillating portrayal
mm-hmm.
of sexuality.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what was so controversial about it, is people see this movie, and I don't care who you are, whether you like it or not, you have a visceral reaction to
mm-hmm.
it, because you understand, even if you haven't been in a sexual relationship that's quite that intense, you
mm-hmm.
understand through the filmmaking what's going on between these two characters,
right.
and it immediately sparks this reaction inside your body that's almost physiological. You feel like there's hormones being released in your body while you're watching this movie. It's a strange experience the first
mm-hmm.
time you see that movie.
Yeah. Another film that belongs here, and again probably higher, number 8, is Natural Born Killers.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was incredibly controversial for a number of reasons. I mean, obviously the violence and the violence that it indirectly caused. That
and
was,
you know what?
That was...
That's a movie that's designed to be controversial. It's not one of those where if people are going to call controversy on it, it's not one of those the director can defend by saying, well, you haven't even seen it.
Right.
You know, the experience of watching it should feel controversial.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it's speaking to the abhorrent kind of things that we accept in our society that feed this violence and stuff, things that we should find controversial but mm-hmm. don't. You know,
yeah,
right.
It's a great message, and honestly, I know you don't agree with me, Jamie, but I think Jerry does. I don't think that message has ever been delivered as well as it was in that movie. And in fact, I think that's the problem some people have, is they can't see past the violence that's on
yeah.
screen and see the message that is behind it.
Yeah, I
got
to
say, it's a little
bit
difficult.
It takes more than one viewing to really appreciate that movie, and it takes actually doing some like research about. You know, reading about the movie also years later, like I did, to really truly appreciate it. Because
mm-hmm.
I think if you just do it, first of all, at least if people see it and have that reaction, that's great. Remember, we're dealing with a lot of people who never even saw the movie and just dismissed it out of hand.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it took me a couple of viewings to say this, but no, the movie has value, especially, I'll never forget the video store that we used to have up the street from us. I guess this was 95, 96, and a girl worker said, that's my all-time favorite movie is Natural Born Killers.
Mm.
And that really made me think, okay, the younger kids really admire this movie. I got to find out why.
And that made you think, I don't want to spend any time at all with this person.
No, I didn't. I was just like, okay, that's not good. All right, that's great. This of all the great movies we have, this is the one you're going to fixate on, but... No, I think it's important because there is a certain generation that really adores this movie, and I think that's important to find out why.
I think that we owe a lot to Oliver Stone for that movie. I mean, I know it's a Tarantino script, and I know there's a lot of controversy just in that point, that
mm-hmm.
you know, his script was so changed by Oliver Stone. But I've read the Tarantino script.
It's
and,
not that different.
No, it's not radically different, but some of the undertones,
mm-hmm.
some of the the choices that he makes as a director in terms of the visuals and the different different styles, that's what makes it so effective, not necessarily the script.
Because I read the script, I guess, like 9 years ago, Chris, but from what I remember, the big difference is he focused more on Robert Downey Jr.'s character, Tarantino, if I'm not mistaken. That was the big major difference, was he focused more on them than the actual killers.
And he also, and when the focus was on the killers, it was a lot more glamorous. It was a lot more, it does come across as a little bit more glorifying the violence and making.
Yeah, I would see if Tarantino had directed that, it would be more of a thrill ride. Where with Oliver Stone, it's more of a commentary. But this goes back to the Da Vinci Code conversation. The reason why the controversy remained was because it was a damn exciting movie. It was a vital movie. It worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It wasn't boring as all hell. Number 7 is The Birth of a Nation. Obviously,
I don't need to say anything.
a major classic, a major KKK recruiting tool, and a movie that Griffith made Intolerance to apologize for.
Yeah, remember what Woodrow Wilson said, I think, at the premiere. He said, this is the most important film ever made. It should be seen by everyone.
Right.
Yeah, so.
But we were played with censorship even then.
Yeah.
I mean, even in 1915,
mm-hmm.
within the first 20 years of the invention of this medium, we were plagued with the idea of censorship.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. Number 6, I think, needs to be number 1, actually. Anybody got a guess what it is?
Schindler's List? I have no
idea. The Night Porter.
No.
Okay.
The Last Temptation of Christ.
Ah, well, of course. Yeah.
You cannot be. I mean, in our lifetime, I mean, there's very few movies that have caused this kind of uproar. We had, just in our little town, Chris, we had people going to local theaters saying, if you play this, we'll burn down your theater.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were people standing on the sides of the roads with the banners and the signs. And again, one of these movies that, again, like The Da Vinci Code, if you sit and watch it, it's not what you're thinking. It's not what it sounds like from the poster and from the title. It's actually, I think, a sensitive and compassionate portrait of Jesus Christ.
It is. I agree.
This
with
is you. One of those movies you have to watch before you speak on it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this: is the Pasolini film The Gospel According to St. Matthew on this list?
No.
Because that's, I think, well. Because a lot of people in the, I'm sure that Mel's movie is higher up on the list, but the Pasolini version of the Christ story is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen as far as
But it might not be on this list, I think, because this movie, or this list is just strictly about movies that when they were released had huge controversy surrounding
them. Yeah, I don't
them.
Think the, I mean, I'm sure the Pasolini film did have controversy, but not in the league as some
and
of Pas- these.
Pasolini made one that was more controversial, didn't he? The one that just got released on Criterion last year? By the girl that was raped and tortured?
Dude, that's one of the most... if that's not on the list, though, Salo, if that's not on the list, this
no,
is not a complete list.
I don't think it's on the list. Okay. I think they're just going American, too. I don't think...
Okay. I thought I'd ask, you know.
Triumph of the Will.
Oh,
well,
true
true
that.
True.
True that.
True that. Oh, my God.
One group even offered to buy Last Temptation for $6.5 million so they could destroy it.
God, I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean,
amazing.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think that needs to be number one. But number
well, now
we
I'm
still
very
we still got
five. What number one is then?
Yeah, we still got five more. Number 5 is JFK. Again, another Oliver Stone, and that was one of those that were extremely controversial before he even started rolling.
Yeah,
so,
oh, of course.
That Vanity Fair attack.
It still has controversy surrounding it. You know, you can't bring that up in a room of more than 5 people where one or 2 people go, that's not, there's nothing accurate in that movie. It's pure lies. You know, you can still get into a very heated debate quite easily about that movie with many, many people.
Oh yeah, Oliver Stone. That's what he used to. I don't know about anymore, but he does bring that out in people, and I think that's what makes him, you know, definitely one of the most fascinating filmmakers of our time, is that he can do that. That's an incredible thing to have.
Mm.
Yeah.
And one of the great films of ever, in my book. Number four is Deep Throat.
The most important film of my lifetime, that's for sure. You think I'm joking. I'm not. Dude, that's in a very important movie. It ushered in just a whole... one of the most interesting industries ever produced in this country. I can see why that's always going to be on the list, and I'm surprised they didn't pick some others, but yeah, if you're going to pick one, that's the one to go with.
Yeah, I mean, it really was the first one that put it in the mainstream, that genre of film. But it also, I mean, the First Amendment rights were questioned. They were put on trial. They were charged with obscenity. So it did lead the way for some big things in terms of, you know.
Yeah, no.
Whatever acceptance there is of that genre.
How long ago is Behind the Green Door? How long after that, or how after Deep Throat is that?
Oh, probably 4 years. I'm not sure. I think Behind the Green Door was maybe 76.
Okay, just curious.
I'm not sure, but I'm no expert. But Deep Throat, and of course Linda Lovelace. What an interesting, and they want to make a movie of her too. I've been hearing that for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, they definitely. I'm sure now they want to make one about Marilyn Chambers as well, since she just passed away. So.
Yeah. Number three belongs on this list: Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah,
at the time, certainly, because it was the first film to really, really go after Bush and the Iraq War. By today's standards, it's nothing, because it became like the common ground. But at the time, no one. Michael Moore was the first person in the mainstream to really go after George W. Bush.
Yeah, and this is the problem with this movie, and I'm sure we've discussed it before. It's got an expiration date on it. You know, it's it's not one of those that really last for you.
But it does and it doesn't, because we don't know everything. You still in this country, I mean, I hear this every day at work. I mean, we have people that, I wouldn't say a large part, but there's a sizable minority in this country that does not believe the official story of 9/11. So this film doesn't have the expiration date yet, one would think, because they're just people who really don't believe the official story.
Well, I don't think that. I don't necessarily think that it's arguing.
No, it's not. I'm just saying that I don't.
It's not arguing that story like the whatever that one group.
No, the one, the Loose Change documentary, obviously.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
that. But I do think
Zeitgeist.
This film, God, don't get in the Zeitgeist. We'll be here all night.
Well, I'm just saying that's the movie that would, that's the movie that you're talking about, really.
Yeah.
Zeitgeist and Loose Change are the two that, we'll be here for weeks.
I just think that Fahrenheit 9/11, its value now is mainly as a cautionary tale.
Yeah,
it
is.
Don't let this happen again.
Yeah, and he says that in the last third. He does a beautiful job of saying that, too.
I do remember seeing that film opening night, walking out of the theater, being attacked by this woman with pamphlets and stuff. The cops took the woman screaming and threw her in the back of their squad car. So, I mean, I sense that controversy walking out of the theater. Number two, A Clockwork Orange. Definitely.
That at the time, I mean, they just recently were allowed to show that, right?
In 2000. In 2000, yeah. And Kubrick was the one that pulled it. Because he didn't like the what it inspired.
Right.
He was afraid of that. That means the number one has to be...
Mel Gibson.
Right.
Passion of the Christ, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Now,
even so, I never sensed that The Passion of the Christ was more controversial than The Last Temptation of Christ.
I agree with you to an extent. I do think, though... as a Jew, the film leans that film towards a couple scenes that I'm not going to say are deliberately anti-Semitic, but can be construed that way, that make you feel uncomfortable. Here's the thing. I think the film works. I don't think it's a great film, but I think it works. There's a level, the movie's about fear first and foremost, and that's the whole movie is about. Is just there's a level of fear in it. But the controversy before the film came out. Yeah, after the film you watch it, it dies down. But there's some stuff going on the op-ed pages, Jamie, that and on the news shows that was really uncomfortable.
Right.
I mean, really, like, really uncomfortable. I wish that people, just the film came out, because the stuff that you hear before that for the 6 or 7 months is just really uncomfortable. But you watch the film, you're like, okay, he tilts this more than some other filmmakers have, and, you know, with the blood libel and everything, that's, you know, kind of very uncomfortable, but, you know, it's not the end of the world.
Well, if it upset, if it angered the Jewish population, I still don't think that's a drop in the bucket compared to the entire Christian population that was rallied against Last Temptation.
Oh, you mean the outrage?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, the outrage.
I'm talking about the...
No, there are no Jews. No, the Jews were not going to burn down any theaters.
Yeah.
Okay, I will give you that. But I think as the cinematically, though, there are some images in The Passion of the Christ I could live without.
Yeah, I mean, it's a we've talked about Passion
yeah.
before. Okay, so that's that list. I want to talk about two things real quick, and then if you guys have anything you want to bring up. First thing, there's a new project from David Lynch on his website,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be free. On the outset, it sounds really weird.
I am glad I'm sitting down.
I know, really, my God, because I would have fallen over.
It's called the David Lynch Interview Project. He has people go around all over the country, pull random people and interview them. It's a 121-part series that will air every 3 days between June 1st and next year, June. And I've seen the first episode, and it was very moving. It's a guy talking about, you know, he beat cancer, he's an old guy, and he's saying, I don't think any at all about my mother, but about my father. But I have dreams all the time about my mother, and you know, my mother was a saint. And he's like near death almost. You get that
mm-hmm.
sense from him. And I watched it. I was like, this is very moving. And so I'm excited about this project. Just average people at random from all parts of the country. I think what a great idea.
Well, who's doing the interviewing, though?
Yeah, that's what I want.
You don't hear the interviewers. It plays almost like a monologue because
like
they cut the questions out. Yeah,
right.
It's not Lynch doing the interviewing.
Okay, so what exactly is his involvement? He's just shepherding the project, basically.
He's shepherding it, and he's sponsoring on his website.
So huh. This is why he couldn't let us interview him.
It's his brainchild, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I can see how that would be interesting. You know, NPR has been doing a program similar to this for,
mm-hmm.
for a while now called StoryCorps.
Right.
Where they just have people interviewing everyday people. And this is a two-way conversation, typically between family members. And it is, and those are just audio interviews. And it is pretty striking, and it speaks to the fact that you can make a movie or you can make a story out of just about anything, and screenwriters and filmmakers get a little bit lazy sometimes, but there's just millions and billions of great stories out there to be told, and sometimes it's best just to hear them from the horse's mouth. You know, it can be very, very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds great. I'd like to see this.
Yeah,
I think there's great value in it. So June 1st, that'll be up, but you can preview the first episode on Entertainment Weekly's website at EW.com. It's like 10 minutes per segment, something like that. Second, the big news that came out last week about Martin Scorsese's next film, probably after Silence, the thing he's doing with Bardem and Daniel Day-Lewis,
mm-hmm.
Which also I want to talk about the Nine trailer, if you guys have seen that. This new Sinatra biopic. Scorsese, I'll throw out my opinion, and then you guys can chime in. Perfect director for a Sinatra biopic. I'm picturing the grandeur and the fast cutting and the way he uses music is unparalleled, like a casino kind of thing
mm-hmm.
With Sinatra's life. The Reservation, it's controlled by the Sinatra family. They have final veto or approval on how they tell his story, and they own all the music and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I see whitewash, but at the same time, Scorsese's behind this. He wouldn't accept, I wouldn't hope, a whitewash script that's being written by Phil Alden Robinson, or the Phil the Dreams guy.
Yeah.
But that's my concern. How about you guys?
I agree with what you're saying, but the only thing I will say is that I read a couple books about Sinatra, and there is controversy in his life, and there's some ugliness, but there's nothing that's too over the top that I think can't be touched on, especially by Scorsese, in a tasteful way that the family will, you know, sort of allow it. You know, his ties with the mob and just basically his personality too.
Yeah.
He was known to be a real kind of a son of a bitch.
I don't think you can whitewash that. I think, and that's common knowledge, really.
Yeah,
a lot of
it's been something that they've wanted to avoid at all costs.
Look at
to tarnish his image. Yeah.
Yeah, but look at that HBO movie, The Rat Pack, kind of touched on those things too. And
which was completely unauthorized. The only authorized thing that they've done is the '92 TV movie, which was a complete. It was like Wonder Bread. It was so. It was so nothing. You know, there was nothing to it.
Well, so if anyone can get around this, it's Scorsese.
Well, is the script by Robinson already written?
Apparently not. Apparently it's not done.
Well, that will be interesting. I feel like that will. I feel like if that script gets written and the script that Scorsese wants to direct is not accepted, I feel like Scorsese is the kind of director who would definitely back out if he can't make the movie he wants to make.
That's the second thing I see happening. I see that this script will be entangled. And all this bickering, and Scorsese will finally just back out. Because Scorsese has wanted to do the Dean Martin story forever with Tom Hanks, and he wanted to throw in a lot of that stuff in this script as well.
Yeah.
So who knows? But they've announced projects before that have never come to fruition. But it gets all the movie geeks salivating because this is such a perfect pairing with Scorsese and Sinatra.
Yeah, look at all the movies.
And I know they're using the real Sinatra music too. They're using the Sinatra audio, so the thing is they don't need an actor that can sing. But that's another question that has to be raised. Is already we've heard talk about guys like DiCaprio, who's actually synonymous with Scorsese these days.
Yeah.
And then there was a rumor that the studio wants Johnny Depp. Now, don't get me wrong, I love both those guys, but I don't see either one of those guys capable of playing Sinatra. I'm sorry, I just don't.
I've been thinking about this, actually.
I don't know, Chris.
I think you need a great actor. I don't necessarily think it's important that he fits the mold completely. I mean, if you wanted to go outside a great actor, which I think he's a decent actor, but not a great one, you'd pick somebody like Harry Connick Jr.
Exactly what I thought.
Yeah.
Does Ray Liotta look anything like Sinatra?
That's what I was thinking. Ray Liotta might, you know, would be, you know, work, you know.
Well,
yeah, he's already done it. I'm just asking about that one movie.
Yeah.
He didn't look anything like Sinatra, but he's such a good actor. It didn't take me long to accept him.
Yeah.
Sinatra.
I think they should find an unknown, and I think every time someone goes outside of the box, maybe not every time, but for the most part, when people go outside of the box and they look around the country and really try and find a good unknown actor, there's so many great unknown actors out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It does feel like too many scripts get offered to the Johnny Depps and
and
the Leos. So again, I think Scorsese will be strong enough to find the right guy. So I have comfort in that, but those two choices just don't strike me. And it's not just physical. Neither one of those guys, I mean, Sinatra was a really, really dynamic personality, like incredibly dynamic. And then you hear people talk about that in interviews and in all the books. When he walked in the room, it was a force, a presence that just walked in the room. He had gravitas like you would not know, like you would not imagine. And he had that up until the day he died.
He had that sort of
presence.
I think you're shooting for Antonio Sabato Jr. Is that what you're you know, and I don't think you can get better than Don Cheadle as Sammy in that Rat Pack movie.
Yeah.
Sammy is really, how do you cast Sammy? The most talented person that ever lived in my book.
Look for Jamie Foxx to get this role. I'm going on record right now.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put it past him. But, I mean, he physically, and we're just talking about it doesn't matter with Sinatra, the physicality. I mean, Sammy was a little guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
he was tiny.
Yeah, he was tiny. So, I mean, Jamie Foxx will have to start the crack diet or something now.
Oh, God. But I think Chris is right, actually. An unknown is the way to go with Sinatra. Because then it does seem like caricature almost.
Yeah, I feel like Sinatra is too big to get someone else that's big to play that part.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be able to. I mean, yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio didn't look anything like Howard Hughes, but he stepped into that part, and he did it so well that you kind of forgot that it was Leo. But that's Howard Hughes. That's not Sinatra.
Yeah, but
I
think the same thing applies here even more so. Because Howard Hughes was an enigmatic guy that was in the shadows anyway. I think it would be wrong to go with the dead-on people for Sinatra biopic with all the roles, because then it'll play like it can play like parody.
Mm-hmm.
It can play like an impersonation, like an SNL skit.
Well, that's always a risk to take with these kind of films. I mean, that is just a risk to take with any of these kind of films.
Well, take a look at Nixon. And Nixon's a movie that I've always been conflicted by.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've always been conflicted because I like Hopkins' performance in the movie. That said, he does not look like Nixon, except for a couple of fleeting moments in the movie where he sort of resembles Nixon. I like his performance, but it doesn't feel like Richard Nixon to me for some reason. I can't really put my finger on it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
See, for me, he embolizes... He's such a great actor. He represents everything that construction of that character needed. And you understand Nixon in a way that somebody that looked like him with lesser acting chops possibly couldn't have pulled off.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing. Speaking of Daniel Day-Lewis and Scorsese, I'm jumping all around.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they're about to shoot Silence, which, again, is a Scorsese movie that doesn't interest me when I read the plot. And then I see Day-Lewis, Javier Bardem, and Scorsese, and I'm very excited.
Oh,
but Nine, the new musical, the most pedigreed movie this fall, Oscar winner after Oscar winner in this thing. They released the trailer this week. Did you guys get a chance to see it?
Yes.
I have not seen it yet. I have not.
Wow, Jerry, you should get online. I don't know how good your computer screen is, if you can download HD.
Oh yeah, I can download AC. I'm not going to do it now though, while we're on the show, but I'll definitely do that tonight.
No, I don't mean now, but tonight you should definitely download the HD trailer and take a look at it, because this movie, I don't know about the story, I don't know anything about what this movie is actually about, other than it's about a film director who's making a musical.
But isn't it the musical version of 8.5?
Yeah, it is.
Okay,
so essentially, Day-Lewis is playing Mastrantonio, his role as Guido.
Okay, he just won the Best Actor, or he will be nominated. Let's put it like that.
Well, the preview grabs you by the scrotum and does not let go.
Okay,
and
I believe it.
It's really, really a striking preview, and I don't like musicals. I couldn't care less about a musical. I didn't like Chicago particularly, but beautiful and as glamorous looking as Chicago. This preview makes Chicago look like Gummo or something like that. I mean,
Gummo the musical, dude. All right.
I mean, this is pretty polished. It's pretty, but it looks very sexy, very like monochromatic almost in a way. Lots of light and shadows and.
Well, it's quite a cast. I mean, you couldn't ask for better.
Daniel Day-Lewis, Nicole Kidman. For some
Dench.
Reason, Kate Hudson is in there for some reason. Judy Dench, and then Penelope Cruz in her first singing dancing role, which is where she came from.
Mm-hmm.
And she's incredibly sexy in it. And Sophia Loren as his mother. So
this is going to be, and you have Sophia Loren in there, so you already have like a Fellini connection in there. So with all this knowledge, you look at the pedigree and everything. Yeah, this is an Oscar front runner.
Yeah,
if it really goes wrong, this is an Oscar front runner.
This is the prestige film of Thanksgiving time.
Sure.
Yeah. All right, I'll leave it open to you guys in these few minutes before we bring Aaron on for DVD reviews. What you guys got anything?
I don't have anything necessarily to discuss, but I do want to bring up that we made predictions last week about Star Trek box office, and Jamie,
I was way off.
Yeah, I was way off too. I thought, and strangely, Angels and Demons ended up hitting closer to the mark that you and I were predicting for Star Trek, Jerry. But Jamie was correct. Jamie was even over.
I was way off too.
But
I went lower than
yeah.
I predicted like 97 million or something, and
I did 110.
Although I said 105, but we were all very correct about the fact that Wolverine had a 60, huge drop-off. It was like 69% or something like that
What's amazed me, though, is it's made $150 million. It's made back its budget, supposedly.
Right.
But I am, which means there is going to be a second one. So.
Let me say this. I saw two movies that I haven't talked about yet. And they relate to one another, I think. I saw The Girlfriend Experience.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't quite like it.
Yeah, I got that from your Facebook status the other day.
And then right after that, I watched Rachel Getting Married. Because I hadn't seen that yet. And I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it. And I think it's valuable to watch those movies back-to-back because for everything I found wrong with The Girlfriend Experience, which is kind of shot in a similar way that Rachel Getting Married, Girlfriend Experience came off very postured, very self-conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel Getting Married looked as though you're eavesdropping on these characters and you felt part of them.
That's the key word, eavesdropping, I think, is the key word there.
Yeah.
And I do also have to say that I have not seen Girlfriend Experience, but I liked Rachel Getting Married very much, too. And Anne Hathaway is really blossoming into an incredible actress.
Yes,
really, really becoming. And in fact, I was actually, unfortunately, watching a little bit of Bride Wars yesterday because my girlfriend insisted that we rent it. So I sort of ducked out from the beginning of the movie and sat in and watched the end of the movie. And even in that, Anne Hathaway is, especially alongside someone like Kate Hudson, who, in my opinion, is talentless.
she's not really Goldie Hawn's daughter. I'm sorry, you know. I'm just
She looks and sounds more like her mother in this movie than in any other movie I've ever seen her in.
Really?
And actually, I should mention that Artie Lang actually had the greatest line about Kate Hudson that I think has ever been said. He said, "She's got a smile that you can only have if you've never worked a day in your life."
Artie Lang.
Good. I like that. Go, Artie.
And I think that's quite true, and it is so arty. But back to Anne Hathaway. She is quite, quite incredible in Rachel Getting Married. And I think she's becoming one of my favorite young actresses.
It's a wonderful movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is. And there's such – his love of his characters, man, just shines through. And how much the actors love their characters.
Mm-hmm.
I think of the father and being such a singular presence, and how he's just a joyous presence. And Anne Hathaway, I mean, she plays a woman that's very tortured and confused and in pain,
mm-hmm.
but you know that she loves this girl that she's playing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Has
great
compassion. He's a very compassionate director.
I think in this film, more so than anything he's done recently, and I just think he's also very comfortable going back to his roots, going back to basics more so than a lot of other directors who've gone this track from his generation. It's just amazing to watch this film. Like you said, you're eavesdropping, absolutely.
How about you, Jerry? You have anything you want to bring up?
We said more in this hour than we've said in a long time. We covered controversy, we covered Khan, we covered everything. Star Trek.
All the C words.
In the spirit of summer movies, I think we should do another little prediction about next week's releases.
I'm curious about next week's. Which do you think will do better, Terminator or Night at the Museum? I keep wanting to call it Nightmare at the Museum, but Night at the Museum 2.
I don't like going on record with these things because I'm notoriously bad at predicting these.
You couldn't do as bad as I did last week. Come on.
Well, I was only 5 million below you, so I was pretty close. But this is the first big head-to-head. Obviously, they're going for two different audiences, but they're both huge movies. So I am going to have to go out on a limb, though, and predict that Terminator Salvation is going to be have the bigger audience.
Really?
Because of the PG-13 rating, you think?
Not necessarily the PG-13 rating, but it's also just got a little bit more of a history in terms of the franchise. And I think there's a lot of excitement out there for it. Pretty much everyone I talk to is pretty psyched and seems to have forgotten the fact that the third movie was it was just basically mediocre. It wasn't a bad movie, but it didn't really revitalize the franchise the way that I think the studio wanted it to. And I think people have just sort of accepting that this is a new movie, and it just looks really fantastic.
Terminator also has one more day of release, so it can outgross Night of the Museum. I think that was the thinking there.
Mm-hmm. Well, they wanted to take advantage of these Thursday releases that I guess started with Attack of the Clones, and try to get that extra, like you said, that extra day in there. So
get that disappointment started early.
Yeah, well, I will go on a limb. I think that will be better. This Terminator movie has the potential to be very good because of Christian Bale's involvement. Because before, he did not want, McGee wanted him to play the Marcus Wright character. Because the John Connor part was supposedly really more of a supporting part. And Christian Bale was like, I want to play John Connor. You got to beef this all up. I mean, this is ridiculous. I want to play the good guy.
Well, it got a pretty glowing review, not a typical review, but there's a pretty glowing article about the movie in Esquire.
Okay.
So we haven't seen a lot of early reviews for this movie, but we'll probably see them in the next couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say Terminator 75 and Night of the Museum 60.
I'm going with that one. That makes the most sense to me.
You know what? I'm going the exact opposite.
You want to go Night of the Museum 75 and Terminator 60?
Yeah. I think that Night of the Museum will be number one. I think it's the difference between families of four going to a movie outside of couples of two.
You don't think Dance Flick is going to be this? Going to go by both of them?
I think it'll be clearly the sleeper.
Yeah.
It'll put you to sleep.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Huh?
That's great. All right. We'll hold us to our predictions for next Sunday.
All right.
It should be good times.
We'll know by Friday night. We'll know, now by Friday evening. Pretty much. So we'll know, we'll definitely know by then.
Yeah. Let's talk about some DVDs.
Okay.
Real quick. We got Criterion's new Benjamin Button and a couple other titles that we need to crack off.
Okay.
Aaron, hey, man.
Hey, guys. What's up?
Hey, what's up, Aaron?
What's up, dude? I'm gonna agree with the methods, and actually I do think T4 will be the bigger of the two.
You're calling it T4. That's the first. You're the first person I've heard say that. But okay.
So, Chris, now that Aaron has predicted T4, you want to change your mind?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to go with Dance Flick now.
Well, same thing about Dance Flick. Once again, I would not underestimate Dance Flick putting up a strong number. Obviously, it's not going to be a 50 or 60.
Because of counter programming to the other two movies, one. Bona fide comedy of the group.
Look at something marketed to the urban audience like Obsessed, which is already at 50 million.
True.
Well, a weekend on its own, but
not even necessarily counter programming, but those spoof movies have a history in the last year or two of doing very, very well.
I would give it between 12 and 15, generous.
And I must say, I did laugh at the Dance Flick trailer as opposed to some of these other spoof trailers and suppose of these other Wayans Brothers movie trailers. I actually did laugh a couple of times.
Well, that's your glowing recommendation.
Dance Flick. So I do think, and I can say this so we can all have a headache and mention the elephant in the room. I cannot wait for Armand White's glowing review of Dance Flick.
You and Armand
have his site bookmarked just for that occasion. So
because he's going to love it.
Oh, it's going to be the greatest film ever.
Mm. Okay. Benjamin Button, The Curious Case of the new Criterion version. It's a two-discer.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron, you and I have seen it.
And we've seen it, and I guess we can cover all fronts here. You have the standard def, and I have the Blu-ray. Is there anything really we can say that we haven't already said about this film? It's a terrific film.
Not to review the movie necessarily, but this is, and we've already reviewed the controversy surrounding Criterion coming out with it. So just in terms of, I suppose, the extras and the treatment of the film, and this has pretty much the most exhaustive documentary you can imagine on the making of a movie.
Yeah, as they call it, trimester 1, 2, 3, and then birth is how
it's longer than the film.
It is longer.
Wait, how long is the documentary? I have the disc, the Blu-ray right here. How long is it?
It's about a little over 3 hours. I mean, it's not too longer than the movie, but it is longer than the movie.
Wow.
It's about 3 hours. And that's not even including the extra little featurettes outside of the documentary.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Other little things.
Who directed the documentary?
It's David Pryor, who's done the other, you know, did the Panic Room and did the Fight Club, so he's always done the Fincher stuff. And it's just, it's one of those, it's the highlight of that, of this month from Criterion, of its titles. I really want to single out one of my favorite things, and I wish it was a bigger booklet, but the Kent Jones essay.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
It really is a good one.
Okay.
Kent Jones, who in the May-June film comment, they have an article by Philip Lopate talking about changing critics' second opinions, going back and whether films they love and then they realize they don't, or vice versa. And Kent Jones wrote a little sidebar going and reversing his opinion on The Game, which he now loves.
Oh, and that was written by Philip Lopate?
No, well, Lopate wrote another article. But on the sidebar, Kent Jones writes about changing his mind about The Game. Now he loves the film. So,
okay, because I have a great book by that he edited, Lopate. I'm sure that you have, Aaron, also American Movie Critics.
Yeah, the American Movie Critics.
Yeah, so, no, that's wonderful. I'll look for that.
Did that just come out, that book? I wanted to send an interview request about that book. There was a documentary about film critics that just came out.
Yeah, there's a documentary. I know which one you're talking about. I don't have the name on the top of my head, but I know what you're talking about.
That documentary, it's still going around. It's in the festival circuit.
If you find the name of that documentary, send it to me, either one of you guys.
Okay, all right.
I actually know the filmmakers. I've met the filmmakers.
Well, okay.
But no, so back to Benjamin Button.
Yes.
Terrific film, terrific disc. I mean, I don't know what the controversy was about the Criterion involvement with it.
What was that about?
We already talked about it on the show last week.
I think when some of us heard it, we thought it was kind of the textbook definition of no-brainer, of Criterion and Benjamin Button being together. So it's a perfect disc. It'll probably
They'll do The Game or something like that, some other Fincher movies as well.
Well, essentially it boils down to what Chris was referring to earlier as literary snobbery. It's Criterion snobbery. It's, what are you releasing this for? It's popular.
Well, they do that. I mean, that goes back. Look what they do for The Rock and Armageddon. I mean, they do.
Well, yeah. Occasionally they need people to actually buy their discs.
Yeah,
The thing about The Rock and Armageddon, I mean, those are really kind of isolated cases where they were kind of experimenting, and I think they've realized that there's a difference between doing a commercial title, if you will, and then doing something that's kind of, not so much a commercial title, but just kind of a crass mass marketing title, like Armageddon. But in defense, and the thing about this literary snobbery thing, it sort of has occurred, but the thing is, it's also the discretion of particularly with someone like Fincher, who knows that a film like Benjamin Button needs that kind of care.
Right.
And the thing, and the thing about Benjamin Button, one last thing, is that it's not a universally liked film.
Right. Well, yeah. Chris doesn't like.
No, not sadly, but I.
Chris thinks it's okay, but and Chris would love this special feature too. It's like a semi documentary about why Benjamin Button is better than Slumdog. I think that was made just for him.
I was adhering to the not review the movie policy that we set.
Yeah, I know. Really? Goddamn, Jamie. Why don't you just open that can of worms? Why don't you?
I needed to get a rise out of Chris.
One of the interesting things, I think I might have sent a link to you, Jamie. If not, I'll do it again. Friend to the show, Matt Diller Seitz, he recently did a video essay on kind of the polarization of Benjamin Button.
Right.
For the Moving Image Source, the online magazine of Moving Image, the Moving Image Museum, and that's a very fascinating essay that really kind of encapsulates the, you know, Benjamin Button's one of those odd films, and that I think it is kind of one of those. You wouldn't think of it, but it is one of those either or films. You either go with it or you don't. And,
yeah.
It's kind of interesting that it's one of those films.
I would just like to say, of the five films nominated for Best Picture, this is the one that is staying with me, not the others. I like Frost Nixon. I like Milk. But it's the curious case of Benjamin Button that just grows stronger the more I think about it. It has more going for it, I think. There's just a lot of little things in the movie I love, a lot of little touches. And it's just that's the one that's going to stay with me as far as what was nominated.
Here's the question, and then we'll get on to the next disc. Obviously, this is a beautiful disc. It's got so much on it, almost too much, but it's comprehensive as it gets. So if you appreciate the movie or just appreciate Criterion, this is a must-purchase, I think. But the in-depth nature of that documentary, 3+ hours, you know how everything was done. Is that damaging?
Not for me. I mean, not for me, because that was always a question for me when I saw the film. Because I knew it wasn't something as simple as, well, different actors at different times, and then they replace them. I mean, Fincher's not working that way. So I was curious on the... and I think anyone who loves the film is curious about the logistics of the film. I would say it's a near-perfect package. I would say I was kind of a little disappointed. The one thing not included I would have thought would have been nice was a replica of actually... the short story of the
right.
But I thought it would have been kind of a nice, not that anyone would read it, because God knows no one has time to read anymore, but it would have been a nice addition.
That's actually not a bad idea, Aaron. That's a good idea. I also think Aaron deserves some kudos, because he was the first one out of all of us to see it, and he was the first one to come back and tell us how wonderful it was.
Yeah. So, I think it is one of those things that's going to stay around for years and years. I will qualify this, and this is splitting hairs, that I still think Zodiac is his best film overall.
Mm. I like so many of his films, man, but
I can't make a decision, Aaron. I like Jamie, I like a good chunk of them, so it's hard.
I can't get that first experience of watching Seven out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the all-time great gut-wrenching experiences watching a movie, and it's tied in with that first experience of seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, how about you? If you had a qualify favorite Fincher, what would it be?
Yeah, I agree. Tough to make a decision. If we're talking about films, just looking at the film on its own, not the experience, yeah, I'd have to go with Aaron. Zodiac is quite incredible. And just each time you watch it, somehow it seems more incredible and more engrossing and more tragic, and I think that's his biggest achievement. Unfortunately, not a popular movie, but none of his movies have been, recently he has not been making terribly popular movies.
Well, Benjamin Button did well, well, but as popular though, I mean, Seven may be his most popular film in that regard.
Yeah. Okay.
Don't forget his video for "Express Yourself" by Madonna.
I knew you were going to bring that up.
Okay, you got another Blu-ray of another classic, Big.
Big. 21 years ago this month, actually, if I remember correctly, I think it was either the last week of May or the first week of June when Big came out, and this was kind of the coming out of really Tom Hanks. He of course, there was Splash. But then kind of after that, it was kind of a hit and miss. Splash followed by Volunteers, and The Man with One Red Shoe, but then you had something underrated like Nothing in Common.
That's a wonderful film.
Why hasn't that gotten the DVD treatment? I always love Nothing in Common.
He and Jackie Gleason were great.
Nothing in Common is underrated, and then he's serviceable, and he's funny at times in Dragnet, but Dragnet's really... Dan Aykroyd and Dabney Coleman show.
But that's another funny one, though.
Yeah. But then
Bachelor Party, Tony Katane's best work.
I'm not going to argue with you there.
That's the best work of my man Adrian Zmid.
Zapped was pretty good.
But then Big comes out, and this is the Penny Marshall's second directorial effort after the underrated Jumping Jack Flash, and I'm not being facetious. Written by Spielberg's sister, Ann Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was one of those films. I actually remember not only... This film never hit number one, but it was like in the top five.
It was magical.
For weeks and weeks. To the point, I actually vividly remember like late August, early September, Big still being like number 10 or number 9.
You're right.
You know, just one of those that stuck around. And then the late summer, we got Punchline, which is an underrated Tom Hanks performance, and that's kind of where it all starts, of him being that Tom Hanks persona. And of all the body-switching slash movies that we got around the time, I think it was Big, 18 Again, Like Father, Like Son, Vice Versa, Dream a Little Dream.
17 Again.
Big is obviously the best one, although I have a soft spot for Vice Versa.
Dude, Aaron, I think you deserve a medal for admitting that on the air, dude. I mean, that's...
Anyway, what's on this disc, dude?
Well, they have some... Hey, Vice Versa is awesome.
All right, what's on this disc?
Go with your passions.
Okay. What's on one of the cool things, it has something different other than... It doesn't have... It's not so much a commentary or a documentary, but it's a combination of two, what they call an audio documentary. And it kind of puts together these... They're reading memos and back and forth on the evolution of Big, and so you get kind of this through all these pre-production notes, and that they're reading Ann Spielberg and Gary Ross, producer, are going through. You get kind of this slash commentary slash documentary in audio form over the film, and that's really that's kind of fun. It's done better, I think. This type of idea was also done on the Domino DVD, which unfortunately Domino's a shitty movie, but it works here on Big. And of course, you know, there are a lot of permutations of what the story was. I think Jamie might have, I think you told me this, or I thought, I mean, at one point Robert De Niro was going to be the he was tapped for this role, but then he bowed out to do Midnight Run.
And he used that character for Awakenings instead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
I'm kidding. It's a joke. I love how you guys are agreeing, like it's like I just didn't say something completely ridiculous.
Well, no, I just think it's kind of funny that you would say that, you know.
Because he is pretty childlike in Awakenings.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the
and Cape
that's
Fear.
The point.
And Cape Fear, where he's a problem child.
So how does it look? Does it look...
Is it worth purchasing?
It is worth purchasing. I mean, I've always thought Big was worth purchasing. It's a you know, I always think Penny Marshall is actually an underrated filmmaker between this, Awakenings, which I think is an amazing film, and then A League of Their Own, which I think is a terrific film. I think he really had, for a while there, had a real good pop sensibility of a filmmaking, of commercial filmmaking. And once again, and Tom Hanks doing some of his best comedic work with Penny Marshall, not only in Big, but in A League of Their Own, where he could have gotten nominated for supporting actor. So
right.
Big's a terrific film, and starring one of the Elizabeths.
Montgomery, right? Yeah. Perkins, right? Okay. So you had two John Wayne movies that have come out.
This is the continuation of Paramount's wonderful Centennial Collection, and these are the next two for the month of May. And these are two John Wayne films, two disc editions. One is Howard Hawks' El Dorado.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is John Ford's The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Oh, both
classic westerns. Commentaries by Peter Bogdanovich, where he uses his archival recordings with interviews from these people.
Mm-hmm.
And then a second disc with a 7-part documentary on the history of both of these landmark films. El Dorado, obviously interesting because it's Wayne and Robert Mitchum kind of doing a redo of Rio Bravo. Which is already out on DVD and Blu-ray special edition. Rio Bravo, the classic, and El Dorado is kind of a rethink of that. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is kind of an interesting, is a film, a real early deconstruction western about myth, famous pop title song that was a big hit at the time. And they're both just, once again, Paramount is, they really, by this Centennial Collection, now granted they're only focusing on these older titles, they've really upped the ante of finally doing justice to some of their catalog films.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I give them, they're finally coming in and really doing justice by some of these films.
Okay. All right. So you can purchase these discs through our website here.
Right.
Just click on the icon of Benjamin Button up there.
Benjamin Button is out. Big is already out. The two westerns, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and El Dorado, they come out Tuesday.
And don't forget, there's some other great Criterion releases. Like, I also got The Hit, the Stephen Frears
movie.
Incredible film.
John Huston's Wise Blood is another.
Friends of Eddie Coyle, which I'm really looking forward to.
Which I will be, I might be doing a show surrounding Friends of Eddie Coyle, which has never been on VHS, let alone DVD.
It's
so,
a great, great film and great
kind of
book,
the,
too.
The original Boston gangster
it is.
Film.
It's the book, the George V. Higgins book is considered by like Dennis Lehane and Elmore Leonard to be one of the greatest crime novels of all time.
Yeah. You know what? This is something interesting, too, I read that Aaron and I talked about yesterday with Criterion. And it ties in with Cannes, too, with Scorsese. He's gone over there to promote his new plan for film restoration, which is his great passion. And first of all, let me say that this is a great idea, because if 90% of all silent films are gone, they'll never be seen again.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing will happen to the classics we love from the 30s, 40s, 50s, what have you. On up eventually, and young filmmakers will not learn from the great films. They'll learn from, you know, the sitcom movies that that dominate now or something. You know,
right.
So it really is a valuable thing to preserve our history in film. But Criterion struck a deal; they're going to release all of his projects. They're going to have exclusive DVD release rights.
Well, I mean, it's a wonderful three-prong thing that they're doing with the World Cinema Foundation, which is the Film Foundation of America, which Scorsese is part of. I mean, they deal with American films and English-speaking films, but the World Cinema Foundation deals with, you know, films from, you know, different countries, different continents, and so that's terrific, that restoration. But then lining up with B-side marketing, which are kind of forward-thinking in getting the word out there about the restoration of these foreign films. Then
right.
with the Auteur's Notebook site on getting out there about reviews and editorials on these restorations and Criterion putting them out. I mean, it's just a wonderful three-prong kind of multimedia collaboration alliance
yeah.
that Scorsese's done. And there's a terrific – it just posted, I believe, yesterday. There's a terrific podcast on Green Cine Daily between critic and journalist Aaron Hillis and Scorsese, and it's a brief podcast and really getting into the examples of some of these new films that are being.
Oh God, we got to get Scorsese on the show.
Yes,
By the way, I appreciate you promoting somebody else's podcast on mine. And the first project out of the gate is Paul Blart Mall Cop, which I think is very worthy.
Yeah, whatever, man.
Well, it's better than Observe and Report.
I'm bombing tonight. What's going on?
I don't know, dude. You're usually good. I don't know what's going on, man.
I must be in love. Maybe
yeah.
that affects it.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Well, Aaron, thank you, buddy. Your prediction is T4, first place next weekend, right?
T4 with $100 million in one.
That's a bold prediction, my friend, but that's...
Okay. All right. Chris, any final words?
No, I'd just say the same thing Jerry said. $100 million, that's a bold prediction in a crowded weekend.
Yeah, it is. I mean,
we'll see. Hey, I hope it's true. I hope it's a good movie, and
that's
I hope it's
$100 million
in
one.
$101.
You're really counting on that one, aren't you?
This isn't The Price is Right, dude. It's
I know, really.
All right. It's been a good time, dude. Let's all get together again next Sunday.
Okay.
Jerry, you're going to a midnight show.
I'm going
Terminator.
To a midnight show of Terminator Salvation, so I'll you know, so
on Wednesday.
On
and
Wednesday, yeah. But
as of yet,
are
I don't
we doing the show on Wednesday or
as of yet, I don't know, but we have dibs on a really, really big guest next week.
Well, don't tell us,
dude. Keep us in suspense.
You're finally getting Mickey Rooney.
No, his initials are. I'll throw this hint. His initials are FFC.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. That shouldn't be hard to narrow down. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been a great time.
Yes, it has.
And I'll see you guys next week.
All right.
All right.
All right. Good night, everyone. Thanks, everyone.
Happy birthday, Caden.
Happy birthday. Thank you.